Good evening and welcome to Building Bridges, your community and labor report. I'm Amy Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash. And the program is with one of our favorite political artists, David Robax, who is one of the best political songwriters in the English-speaking world today. His songs are a powerful musical challenge to the status quo. They're so effective because they're both politically sharp and contain beautiful poetry.
And now we go straight to David Robax. Well, you know, Ken, it is. We've been trying for a long time to catch up with David Robax, who has a very busy schedule, although I feel like we've caught up to him because we play his songs all the time because they're so apropos to the work we do, which really leads me to my first question, David. There's this bifurcation, this artificiality in the movement at times where they don't seem to understand what culture is, which for me is how the total way people live their life. And so they'll say, we've had about 8 speakers, mm-hmm. people are glazing over, mm-hmm. let's have a song, as though somehow the music and the song and the message is less relevant in that context, or a diversion. And culture as revolution, what does that mean to you?
I think that the crucial thing is that people have hearts as well as minds, and we have to be appealing to both. And music is a lot more effective in other forms of art, plays and skits and paintings and all kinds of stuff is more effective at reaching people on an emotional, visceral level, usually, than speakers are. And, I mean, you know, there's a lot of crossover. Of course, you know, a song can educate someone and a speaker can move someone, for sure. But I think any good rally has to have, I mean, any good rally really, in my view, is 50% speakers and 50% music. Because, you know, what are you trying to do at a rally? I mean, especially at a rally, I think any good conference should have a concert on Saturday night, too. But if you're talking about a rally, you know, especially at that kind of situation, you know, you're trying to inspire people into action. You're not just trying to, you know, say, okay, we're all here, and now let's talk about things that everybody already knows and then go home. You know, the atmosphere at a rally that has music at it and the way people feel at the end of the rally is dramatically different. And that's, I think, anybody who's got their eyes open can see that. But unfortunately, you know, with people who are organizing these kinds of events for one reason or another, you know, often for very understandable reasons, but still, music doesn't end up being a big part of a lot of these things. I mean, for some groups, it's because they're ideologically opposed to culture. You know, I don't know if I should mention names, but you know, but for other
groups, depends how long their leaflet is.
Yeah. But for other groups, it's you know, it's because I think it, often what happens is, you know, you want to have every group that's somehow partly responsible for getting a few people to the rally. You want to, you know, have them be represented on the stage, and by that time, you got no time.
Let me just follow. You said it's kind of visceral, emotional. What about the intellectual level as well? Where's the contribution from the song, from your music?
Certainly, you know, you can write a story, write a song about something that people haven't heard about before. I mean, so on that level, I mean, I don't know how much I'm contributing to the, you know, real higher intellectual discourse, but in terms of just, you know, playing for audiences where, oh gosh, you know, I never knew that, you know, the Coca-Cola Corporation was involved with hiring death squads in Colombia to kill union organizers, and I've run into quite a number of people who, you know, for better or for worse, the first time they heard of that was through my song about it. So certainly, I don't know if that counts as intellectual, but it certainly counts you know, stuff that people hadn't heard of before anyway. Yeah.
You know, you mentioned rallies, but a lot of people think in terms of musicians at rallies that they're up there on the stage and the audience is down there listening. But from what I can see, from what I know about your history, you're down there in the rally playing the music.
Well, I mean, I'll play wherever, you know, but I mean, I like to be on the stages playing at the rallies, but I've certainly played on the streets for years, you know, in the Boston subways, actually, was where I used to make a living. But, I mean, I don't think that, I mean, I think partly maybe what you're talking about is just the sort of separation between the performer and the audience and that kind of thing. And
I mean, you're part of the protest.
Yeah, I want to be, and I'd like to think of myself that way for sure, and absolutely. Although I think that I mean, it kind of brings up the point of, you know, is there a place for having stages and having speakers and performers and audiences and that sort of thing? And I think it's an ancient tradition from all over the world, and I don't think it's a bad thing. It's just a matter of how it's organized and how hierarchical the whole thing is as far as, you know, who's actually on the stage or that sort of thing. But, you know, the tradition of people performing and audiences listening or singing along and with the person who's on the stage, I think, is a you know, old tradition, and it's a fine thing. It's just that it gets weird because, you know, people kind of figure, well, that person is a performer and I'm not. Well, you know, any of us can be performers, you know, but and if you got something to perform, then you can get on a stage and perform it, you know.
Well, I'm not sure all of us can be performers, but leaving that aside, just to punctuate what Ken was saying, I can't help but notice your shirt, which has in big embossed letters there, "We are all Palestinians." And certainly your music, whether you're singing about depleted uranium, whether you're singing about sweated labor, or whether you're talking about self-determination and national liberation, you do synthesize things. Mm-hmm. So that, yeah, you're very much the activist. As a matter of fact, the context I usually see you in is when you could just as easily be the person holding the sign up protesting as well as somebody who's stirring us through your musical endeavors.
Yeah, sure.
There's a picture on your website of you playing through a bullhorn. Tell us about what was happening at one of the big protests.
That was at the IMF World Bank protests in Prague. And I mean, it's kind of embarrassing to admit, but I'm a bit of a snob about sound systems, really, and about a lot of other things, coffee and, you know. But
now we get the lowdown.
I'm very bourgeois, really. But anyway, you know, usually I don't like to play through a bullhorn because you can only amplify either the voice or the guitar. You can't amplify both through a bullhorn, so you kind of end up sounding not very good. But in that particular situation, you know, it was the only place in the entire city of Prague where protests were legal that day. The only place officially was that one sort of park in front of this big church, and we weren't allowed to have a sound system there. So, you know, of course, I sang through the bullhorn because that was the situation.
Well, I appreciate your thoughts about quality because doing anything is about doing it with vigor and with zealous advocacy, and having a sound system is critical, and very often our musicians are not treated as well as they should be as workers in these things. But we've been speaking to you, and that's a delight, but how could we not, as you're sitting there with your guitar tuned up, pick in hand, not get an offering from you? As one of our producers here says all the time, the message is the music.
Oh, great. Yeah, well, I'll do that. I was just to, you know, see if we can piss off more listeners that way.
Never.
This song, I actually, for writing this song, I was scheduled, I don't know, about a year ago to play at a Baptist church in Hartford, Connecticut, where, you know, we were just using the church. It wasn't associated with the, you know, the people who ran the place or anything, but it was a benefit for the Hartford Ocotal Nicaragua City Project. And then the Baptist minister at that church ran across the song lyrics on my website and wrote an email out to the Sister City Project and everybody else in the Greater Hartford Area Council of Churches, and said that David Rovix is a pro-terrorist, anti-American, anti-Christian, and not only is he banned from my church, he said, but anybody else in the Greater Hartford Area Council of Churches who has this guy perform in their church will be kicked out of the Council of Churches.
Well, we welcome your humanity here. That's a great segue.
Welcome to the Church of WBAI.
Thank you. The concert actually went ahead in a Jewish cultural center under the auspices of the Quakers.
So. It's a far better thing.
Child, what will you remember when you recall your 16th year? The horrid sound of helicopter gunships, the rumble of the tanks as they drew near. As the world went about its business, and I burned another tank of gasoline, Dow Jones lost a couple points that day while you were crying in the Sea of Janine. Did they even give your parents warning before they blew the windows out with shells? While you hid inside the high school basement, amidst the ringing of church bells, as you watched your teacher crumpled by the doorway, and in England they were toasting to the Queen, you were so far from the thoughts of so many there in the city of Geneva. Were you thinking of the taunting of the soldiers, or of the crap they smeared upon the walls? Were you thinking of your cousin after torture, or Tel Aviv and its glittering shopping malls? When the fat men in their mansions say that you don't want peace, did you wonder what they mean as you sat amidst the stench inside the darkness in the shattered city of Geneva? What went through your mind on that day at the sight of your mother's vacant eyes as she lay still among the rubble beneath the blue Middle Eastern skies? As you stood upon this bulldozed building beside the settlements and their hills so green, as your tears gave way to grim determination amidst the ruins of the city of Geneva? And why should anybody wonder, as you stepped on board the crowded bus across the green line, and you reached inside your jacket for the cord, were you thinking of your neighbor's buried bodies as you made the stage for this scene, as you set off the explosives that were strapped around your waist? Were you thinking of the city of Geneva?
Wow. Yeah. It's
powerful.
Quite. You actually said something earlier, which I don't know if I should say it's spoken word. It's you're very encompassing as a musician. You're a good guitar player. You've got a nice voice. And you've got such a potent story, which you tell with such poetry, but also such political cogence. It's a total package.
Well, thank you.
It's really quite a pleasure.
Can I quote
David.
You on that?
By all means, it would be my pleasure. You know, this song, you've obviously developed a very profound sensitivity and interest politically in the condition of the Palestinians and the situation in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. What provoked that particular area of the world as something that you would spend a great deal of your song time on?
A whole bunch of different factors. One is my background is Jewish, and when I, you know, learned the reality of what Israel has been doing for the past 55 years and what and how, you know, what really happened, I was just, you know, and that was, I don't know, 10 years ago or something when I first sort of started learning about what was actually going on there. I, you know, was outraged because, of course, I had learned that, you know, Jews are generally good people with a history of being oppressed and struggling against oppression. And then the idea that that there's this government representing, claiming to represent me, and doing, you know, committing these horrible crimes against humanity on a daily basis, I was outraged. And then also, of course, you know, it's our Israel's our biggest client state in the U.S. And as an American citizen, I think I feel obligated to speak out against this. And the contradictions of U.S. foreign policy are so well embodied in our support for Israel. And, you know, as we invade Iraq, because it invaded one of its neighbors here, of course, we have and it has weapons of mass destruction and all that. You know, here we have a country that's been occupying its neighbor for 55 years and has 200 nuclear weapons. And what do? We, you know, send them billions of dollars a year as a reward. And then I just and then it sort of the snowball effect. There's that aspect of it, because I started once I started writing songs about the issue, then I started meeting Palestinians all over the place and then hearing their stories, and then hearing their stories makes me want to write about them. And then I also started getting a lot of hate mail from Zionists, and that was also kind of inspiring as well.
You know, well, we were talking before about making speeches and talking and also the music, but you do both well.
Oh. So. I often feel like I'm just stumbling over the words when I'm talking.
Make it a lot of sense. But I did want to ask you, because I know that a lot of your songs are inspired by our president, George Bush.
Absolutely. Well, he's my co-writer.
So, I mean, I'm sure there'll be some, after Bush, I'm sure there'll be somebody else.
Oh,
but,
yeah. Dean will make a good co-writer.
I'm looking, I could say looking forward, but we shall see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
But tell us more about what you think about our president, and maybe you have a song that relates to that.
Oh, sure. Well, he's, I think, my greatest inspiration, really. He's such a, I mean, you know, all the material comes pre-satirized, is what I like to say, because, you know, he just, and I've heard a number of other songwriters and comics and, you know, talking about that. It's just, they're just making our job too easy, really, because, you know, with just coming out with this, I mean, every day, every speech, it's like the axis of evil and all this kind of stuff. It's just, it's way too easy to make satire of this kind of idiocy. You know, I think, well, on the other hand, I don't think he's necessarily much different than most of the administrations we've had over the past
years. I mean,
years.
I remember, you know, I mean, we used to make fun of Reagan in the same way, but Reagan really did a number on us. So in a way, it's disarming when we do that.
Right.
You know, it's certainly very easy with this president.
It is. Yeah. I kind of prefer him to Clinton, you know, just because he's, I mean, Clinton was an idiot too, but you know, he was a little harder to make satire of, whereas Bush is just incredibly easy. Yeah, I don't know. I wish we could have a parallel reality where Gore won the last election, and then we could, you know, see if he would have invaded as many countries. I'm sure he would have invaded Afghanistan. I don't know about Iraq, but, you know, I'm curious.
And does a song come to mind?
Sure. We've got a situation, and it calls for a solution that upholds our domination of the planet. We're gonna make our case, and we're gonna make it well. And if you don't like our logic, you can it. We'll use impeccable intelligence from any country in the world, as long as we all see eye to eye. And if we don't find quite what we need, we know what to do. Just look into the camera and lie. It's Operation Iraqi Liberation. Tell me, what does that spell? Operation Iraqi Liberation. O-I-L. We'll lie about the missiles and the nuclear research. We'll lie about uranium. We'll build military bases and smile for reporters as we give away bubble gum. We'll lie about Bin Laden, his connections with the Saudis. We'll lie about 9-1-1. We'll lie about the Baathists, their connections to Al-Qaeda, because we know there's none. It's Operation Iraqi Liberation. Tell me, what does that spell? Operation Iraqi Liberation. O-I-L. We'll lie about the North Koreans, and we'll lie about Iran, and don't mention Israel. Keep those nuclear weapons out of this song, and we'll all get together swell. And we'll liberate these people We'll liberate their money. We'll liberate their soil. We'll liberate their harbors. We'll liberate their airports. And we'll liberate their oil. It's Operation Iraqi Liberation. Tell me, what does that spell? Operation Iraqi Liberation. O-I-L. Operation Iraqi Liberation. Tell me, what does that spell? Operation Iraqi Liberation. O-I-L.
Oil. Oh, that's fun. That's fun. That really is. You know, I don't know.
Changed your voice for that also.
Well, you know what it reminded me of, believe it or not? Well, I first came across your music when you were singing things like the Big Rock Candy Mountain.
Oh, long time.
And that's one of the things that I like about your music, that you are worker conscious and working class conscious, because... Well, talking about bifurcation, very often what I find, and I'm old enough to know that the same thing occurred during the struggle against the war in Vietnam, there was a separation from people in terms of their understanding that we are in the belly of the beast, and the change has to emanate from a power structural change here. And that's about working class, and it's about the issues of the working class. And, of course, it's about the issues of national oppression, racism. Mm-hmm. And you do. So it's not just, well, there's the anti-war struggle there, and somehow it has no relativity to the condition of people here.
Absolutely.
I'd love to hear a song about work, workers, global justice.
Sure. Let's see. Well, this is a song from the perspective of a worker. Soldiers are workers, and very, very dangerous job. And there's this wonderful newsletter called the GI Times that I've been getting an email, and I wrote this after reading a few issues of that. And I could do songs about other workers, but here's one about... Lost my job and joined the army to get an education. I most surely did. Want to have some kind of steady job, lead a decent life, support me and my wife and kid. First I was based in Texas, then it was off to Germany, then they sent us to Iraq. So many ruined buildings, so many burned up bodies, twisted railroad track. They sent us to Fallujah. We were told to keep the peace amidst such hunger and despair. I was only 21, didn't have a clue what we were doing there. Now they say the war is over and I'm back at home, here in the land of the free. And you're looking at the face of victory. You're looking at the face of victory. Through Fallujah, driving on the rubble, shattered pavement and shattered glass. They sent us on a search for weapons. We looked in every basement, never found a single barrel of gas. When we saw the cities looted, as we watched the oil pipelines, it all began to seem so clear. We were fighting for Exxon, dying for Chevron. That's what we were doing here. They told us we'd be welcomed as troops of liberation. Once again they lied. We got shot at every day. Everywhere we went, a bunch of my buddies died. A rocket launcher hit my tank, started up a fire, blew my legs right off of me. Now you're looking at the face of victory. You're looking at the face of victory. Back to Michigan. They put some plastic on my stumps and sent me on my way. Now I roll on down the city streets, looking at the people as they turn their eyes away. Down at O'Reilly's, they were talking about the government and how it's all a ruse. And I get a little madder every time I see the president smirking on the evening news. I think of how they duped me and so many more good people, and I think of the price we paid. The rich are getting richer, and the bastards are already scheming about the next country they want us to invade. Yeah, I keep on thinking about the situation. I think of Oklahoma City, and you're looking at the face of victory. You're looking at the face of victory. You're looking at the face of victory.
You know, I last night was with one of the fathers who's he's a Mexican.
Mm-hmm.
And he is not a citizen of this country, and his son was involved in the invasion of Iraq and was one of the first to die. And he's now pledged himself to complete the democratic revolution, meaning making sure the children survive in Iraq.
Yeah.
And educating and making sure other children don't die for this war. And you really brought those images to mind for me, given your last song.
Thank you. I wanted to go to that event that you're talking about, I think, last night.
Yeah, it was very powerful, very powerful.
Yeah.
Heard? One of the songs that we play a lot is the Minimum Wage Strike, which I like a lot. So is that a new song, or is that something you've been around for a while?
I think I wrote that in 98.
Considering that we have a number of our sisters and brothers who are on strike in the minimum wage industry, I can't think of a better song to do for Building Bridges, your community and labor report.
When I awoke one morning, there was a feeling in the air. Everything was quiet, things were different everywhere. The Wobblies were back again with Joe Hill at the mic. When all the minimum wage workers went on strike, there was no one flipping burgers. All the grills were cold. Onion rings were in their bags. Fries were growing mold. There were no baristas at Starbucks asking how many shots would you like, when all the minimum wage workers went on strike. There was no one pumping gasoline, no one driving from town to town, no one at the registers. All the highways were shut down. The cars were stuck in the garage. CEOs on bikes, when all the minimum wage workers went on strike. The fruit was falling off the trees, no one to load the trucks. Corn was rotting on the stalk, no farmhands to shuck. Workfare workers were hanging at home, spending the day with their tights, when all the minimum wage workers went on strike. Job. Walmart workers said enough of our labor has been robbed.
Foot Locker was locked up. The boss had to take a hike when all the minimum wage workers went on strike. When I awoke one morning, there was a feeling in the air. Everything was quiet, things were different everywhere. The Wobblies were back again with T-Bone at the mic. When all the minimum wage workers went on strike. When all the minimum wage workers went on strike.
Well, we're going to get our general strike, I can tell. When they all hear this song, they're just going to pour into the streets and stop the means of production and take it over.
That's right.
We've had general strikes, just not in this country since 1882.
This is going to inspire one here, Ken.
Well, we need a lot more songs like that.
We do indeed.
Was it 1934? Was it 1934? I guess that was just the West Coast. Huh?
That was the West Coast, yeah. That was the Henry Bridges, the Longshore Strike.
Right.
Yeah.
You're talking to a labor librarian.
Yeah,
here,
good.
So he's got it down to the minute.
Yeah, good.
I've been waiting all these years, waiting for the general strike.
Oh,
actually,
gee.
There were a lot of general strikes right after World War II. Not nationwide,
right.
But people forget about that.
Like Wildcat.
Right. Yeah, some Wildcat, some authorized. Yeah, mm-hmm. A lot of activity right after World War II. But
well, they'll have to listen to Building that. Bridges more to find out.
I just actually wrote a song recently about the 1921 the West Virginia coal mine.
Oh, Ken would be very upset if you didn't play that.
Yeah, I think I should. I was trying to think of all the songs I got. I got a couple of songs that are really, I would call, labor songs, that are, in terms of what I've been writing over the past few months.
Well, it looks as if, I mean, you started off with a lot of labor songs, and then labor's sort of been not as active as it should be for the last few years, and it looks like you've been
organized labor.
Yes,
right.
Exactly.
That way.
Yeah.
I've been going, well, I guess, after 9/11 and after the U.S.
Yeah.
stepped up its campaign of making war against the rest of the world, I that sort of became my bigger focus somehow. But
well,
I have been writing.
But you've got those songs, so let's go.
Yeah, I'll do this. Well, let's see. How about this one? This is a little more, just stylistically, a little more different than the last one. So. It's about the town that my dad lives in, Danbury, Connecticut, but it could be about thousands of small and large cities around the country. I was young once, it was a long time ago. Things were different than I thought, you should know. This old building was once a factory. We made Stetsons, your grandpa and me. It wasn't easy, but at least life was going down. There used to be a city in this town. This rusted rail yard had a hotel and a couple of stores. We had good times here between the wars. It wasn't paradise, but there was music in the street. Right there's where your grandparents first had a chance to meet. They got married in that church. I can still see her wedding gown. There used to be a city in this town. Change came, it started one by one. First the layoffs, then the factory was gone. Then came the highways, suburbs, and Walmart. That was the final blow that tore this place apart. But it seems like just last year, when there were people all around, there used to be a city in this town. Thank you.
census says there's people here, but I think someone's confused. Just look out at these sidewalks, they're not being used. You know when a city dies, it doesn't die with grief. It just becomes a ruin, shouting this was once the place. I guess it's time to leave, but I don't know where I'd be bound. There used to be a city in this town. There used to be a city in this town. There used to be a city in this town.
You know, you're incredibly prolific. I feel like if we just say something, you're going to take it and turn it into a song.
WBAI song.
Well, we could use one. I know we did one about democracy now, as well as should. But I was also interested about you as Werke, because certainly it's never been the troubadour tradition. I mean, now the country's beginning to understand and pay a little homage to the Woody Guthries or the Pete Seegers. But for the most part, it's darn hard to be a musician worker. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering about your experiences. You are undeterred. Yeah. It must be hard to make a living, though.
It certainly can be. I mean, I've been doing okay for the past few years, but you know, I'm
Tommy Mottola's all set to pick you up. Sony Music.
I got a deal with Damon Records actually, but which is a small indie label that you know, Amy Ray from the Indigo Girls. She started this label up, and it exists largely because of her generosity. Really, I mean, I don't. Which is so often the case with the small labels, I think it's definitely, musicians are definitely some of the lower paid and poorest members of our society. You know,
none of those 401ks and the health benefits and
no. I mean, to some extent, it's for many musicians, it's a voluntary poverty because they could, you know, many of them could perhaps be doing some more better paying job. In my case, I never went to college or never graduated from college and never, I never tried to get a well-paying job. When I was in my early 20s, I was doing word processing and desktop publishing and stuff, and then I got carpal tunnel syndrome from typing too much and got on workers' comp for a year and a half. So during that time, I just spent a lot of time playing music and just, you know, learning songs and playing in the streets in Seattle. And then by the time the workers' comp ran out, I just couldn't imagine, you know, getting a normal job again. And so I moved back to Boston and played in the subways for years full time. And, you know, that's
well, that must have been a nice train to take.
And I imagine you'd be doing better financially if you tailor your music to what the radio stations in general, the mass market stations, would play.
Well, you know, normally I would say that would be true. Like, if you consider that, certainly there's people, you know, the people who are getting regular play on Clear Channel are probably making, you know, generally a far better living than I am. On the other hand, there's, I think, something like a million people in this country who consider themselves to be singer-songwriters, and, you know, mostly they're doing self-produced CDs, and I think I'm probably better off than a lot of them, and I, oddly enough, part of that reason, it seems to me, is actually because I'm doing the particular kind of music I'm doing. I'm not competing with the rest of the singer-songwriters for the folk music market, you know? I mean, it's not folk music fans who are buying my CDs or setting up shows for me. It's the activist community, and I think actually there's plenty of room within the activist community for more people to do the kind of music I'm doing. And I'm also not the only one doing it. Of course, there's other people doing this kind of stuff and making a living basically playing in the activist community.
You know, one of the good things that Michael Moore, there's many bad things that he does, like condemnation in a flippant and cavalier way of Mumia Abu-Jamal in his last book. But he also does one thing that's very healthy, and that is he insists that we not marginalize ourselves, that we not think of ourselves, those who are activists, mm-hmm. who are undaunted by the status quo or challenge it. That, in fact, we are very much of a majority. And I think what you just said is very interesting, that there really is, to use a crass word, a market. Let's change that. There's an audience.
Yeah.
For progressive sound and music, and that's true in all the arts.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I'm glad that that's been brought up. You know, and I think about, like, Michael Moore's last book was hit number one on the bestseller list within a week of its publication. So we are not so much alternative. We are there, and we have to figure out, I guess, how to tap that sentiment.
Yeah. And in so many different styles of music, you find that, you know, it's the, you know, people who are blatantly left-wing and writing blatantly, you know, pro-worker, anti-war, pro-environment kinds of sentiments are hugely popular. And I think, you know, one case in point is Bruce Springsteen, and another is Steve Earle. And
yeah, Rage Against the Machine and Dead Prez and
exactly.
all those.
There's just loads of them, you know. And, you know, sometimes they got their start in all kinds of, I mean, like with in the case of somebody like Steve Earle, I think this is pretty typical where he got popular by being a more mainstream country artist with Copperhead Road and all that, and then he went to prison, came out radical, and
yeah, it'll do it for you.
Yeah. And but he it was you know, he was able to sort of work off of his previous popularity and do all this great radical stuff with the same great musical style that he had before, or you know, talent and you know, songwriting and everything else, and it just applied it to writing stuff about the real world, and he's still just as, you know, about as popular as he was before, but he was able to, I think, you know, use the fact that he was sort of less political before and was signed on with a major label. And I think a lot of other people's cases, of course, they never get the opportunity to be popular in the first place because they're not taken on by some major label or played on Clear Channel. And, you know. But I think it would be silly to think that we couldn't, that this kind of music could not be mainstream. It certainly it can and it is. It's just a matter of a lot of other artists that aren't, not because they're less talented or less appealing to lots of people, but you know, because there is certainly a corporate control over the music industry that only lets little, you know, only some people are able to slip through the cracks and be popular and be radical at the same time. But
well, in an effort to promote that, what's your most recent CD?
It is on Damon Records. There's the Behind the Barricades, the Best of David Rovix, which just came out. Actually, I think 3 days ago was the official release date. And then a couple months ago, my newest CD of all new material is called Return, Al Auda, and it came out on Ever Reviled Records, a little
Ever Reviled
indie, yeah,
Records,
right. A little indie label from New Jersey doing their best.
That should
to
be our motto.
keep themselves marginalized.
It sounds like our station.
In Miami, I was.
That's the FTAA protest.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that just happened a couple weeks ago with the massive police state that was there and everything. And, you know, that there were, first of all, they were only letting, they only let a few hundred people at most into the stadium, or the amphitheater, which could have seated thousands. And they sort of arbitrarily said the place is full. Then it was me and Steve Earle and Tom Morello and Billy Bragg were entertaining.
That's quite a crew.
It was a great lineup for a very small audience. I mean, you know, just my own concerts I've played for a larger audience than that, and you know that they all have. But and then by the end, I was going on sort of first and last, and when I was going on doing my last couple songs to sort of wrap up the thing, I was informed by the organizers backstage that we were now being locked into the amphitheater while the police were tear gassing and clubbing and tasing people on the outside. And they just said, keep on singing. And so I just kept on singing for this literally captive audience. And I always like to consider that, you know, when I used to play in the subways, that my audience was a captive audience, which was what I, you know, really liked about it, because, you know, they usually, when you're playing this kind of music, you know, in the street, people will tend to just walk by. But if they're in the subway and they have to listen for a minute, then they're like, oh, wow, this is kind of an interesting story, you know, and then they get into it if you get a chance to complete one or two songs. But, of course, in the subway, they could walk away into the end of the platform or something. In this situation, they were stuck. You know?
I hope somebody was taping
well,
that.
Well, you know, I mean, the Victor Jara phenomenon, when he was, of course, wrapped up, put in the stadium, not as bleak an outcome, but certainly what was going on in Miami. Gave some terrible signals of the ferocity of the security state when it is confronted with protest.
I think, how about this song? Standing here on a highway, turned into a lake, born on this planet that I didn't make. The ice caps are melting, you can measure the rise of the poisoned oceans, hear all the lies of the political pundits and corporate crooks, their accountants and scientists cooking the books with hardly an inkling of what it's about. Wedded to profit and flooding and drought, I'm talking to you from here at the end of the world. Here on the bayou, amidst mountains of soil, washed up farmland covered in oil, 1 ton every acre, lost every year, and along with the pesticides, it ends up right here. Millions of miles of chemical wheat, challenging all to try to compete and lay waste to your country like we've done to ours. Let them eat coffee, sugar, coca, and flowers. I'm talking to you from here at the end of the world. Here in the city, shrouded in smoke, 10 million people this morning awoke to a future of cancer, industrial disease. So let's build some more suburbs and buy SUVs, cut down the mountains, burn all the coal, and put all the money in a humongous bowl. They'll call it progress and they'll blame it on you to end life as we know it, to enrich the few. I'm talking to you from here at the end of the world. I speak to you now from an occupied place. You might call it your home or a terrorist base. They'll send your sons and your daughters to make sure that it's theirs, while they sit in their mansions on plush leather chairs. And everyone's waiting for us to decide. In dust we were born and in dust we reside. Will we realize the commons is to shepherd and share here in this war zone called land, water, and air? I'm talking to you from here at the end of the world. I'm talking to you from here at the end of the world.
Those are the situations that we have to protest, but you've got a whole bunch of songs about after the revolution,
yeah,
and stuff.
How about that
one? Let's inspire folks to come out and to do something, because essentially you are an optimist. You write about very difficult, very painful situations that encumber the lives of the peoples of the world, and yet there is a tremendous optimism in your music as well.
Yeah, I like what I know Noam Chomsky was quoting someone else when he said it. I can't remember who, but you know, a pessimism of the mind, optimism of the soul, or something.
Mm, yeah. Okay, that works.
I mean,
well, you were both linguists.
I mean, I think when you look at human history, really, I mean, even including the history of the past few thousand years of so-called civilization. It's a really optimistic thing, really. I mean, the general trajectory, if you take it over the long haul, is really pretty impressive. I mean, I know we're in this particular situation now with the third world existing and being made poorer by the rich countries and everything that's happening now. But this is kind of the general trend within the industrialized world, or the civilized, as we use the term, class societies, has been class struggle, and has been victory after victory for the have-nots, really. I mean, that's the overall trajectory. You know, you can point out certain situations and think that it's not the case. But I think if you look at it over the long term, it is a really hopeful history, and I think there's lots of reasons to be hopeful about the future looking at it in the long term. It's always easy to feel like the enemy is monolithic and the capitalists cannot possibly be stopped and Clear Channel is everywhere and whatever, but you know, it's actually, you know, it's a paper tiger to quote.
So you think we could have one of those rip-roaring, enthusiastic,
yes,
inspirational, and you're right, because the process of struggle in and of itself is enlivening,
yeah,
and is also what it's about. It really is the stimulant. So
absolutely.
Let's hear a song to stop the capitalists.
Yes, here we go.
It was a time I'll always remember. I could never forget how reality came down around us like some Western movie set. And when the dust all settled, the sun shone so bright, and a great calm took over us like it was all gonna be alright. That's how it felt to be alive after the revolution. From Groton to Tacoma, on many a factory floor, the workers talked of solidarity and refused to build weapons of war. No more will we make missiles, we're gonna do something different. And for the first time, their children were proud of their parents. And somewhere in Gaza, a little boy smiled and cried. After the revolution, prison doors swung open, mothers hugged their sons, the Liberty Bell was ringing when the cops put down their guns. A million innocent people lit up in the springtime air, and Mumia and Leonard and Sarah Jane Olson took a walk in Tompkins Square. And they talked about what they do now after the revolution. Debts were all forgiven in all the neo-colonies. Soldiers left their bases, went back to their family. A non-aggression treaty was signed with every sovereign state. All the terrorist groups disbanded with no empire left to hate. And they all started planting olive trees after the revolution. George Bush and Henry Kissinger were sent off to the world court. Their plans for global domination were preemptively cut short. Their weapons of mass destruction were inspected and destroyed. Battleships dismantled, never again to be deployed. And the world breathed a sigh of relief after the revolution. Solar panels were on the rooftops, trains upon the tracks, organic food was in the markets, no GMOs upon the racks. And all the billionaires had to learn how to share. Bill Gates was told to quit his whining when he said it wasn't fair. And his mansion became a collective farm after the revolution. And all the political poets couldn't think of what to say, so they all decided to live life for today. I spent a few years catching up with all my friends and lovers, sleeping till 11 home beneath the covers. I learned how to play the accordion. After the revolution,
David Robex, thank you
Very
for
good.
All of your many, many, many inspirations to all of us who care about social justice and are willing to work towards it. And how can people get all of the wonderful, wonderful music of yours?
They go to davidrovex.com. They can order CDs. They can download MP3s and stuff like that. All of my songs from all of my recordings are available for free download on my website in MP3 form.
Oh, are you ever generous?
Yeah, I I try.
And it's www.davidrovex.com.
Davidrovex.com. Yeah.
Com. Oh, you're a com, not an org.
Yeah, right. Okay. I'm not
that communist, yes.
I don't know. When I got the website, I thought you had to be, you know, 501c3 to get an org or
that's
something.
That's okay. We'll turn com from commercial to communist.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Well, David Robex, it's been totally enjoyable to
Thank
have you,
you
with
much.
Us. And we wish you well, and we want to see you number one on that pop chart.
Oh, heck yeah.
For
heck
20
yeah.
weeks in a row.
At least.
Okay.
And you were listening to an interview with David Robex. And, Ken, how can people get in touch with Building Bridges?
www.buildingbridgesonline.org. We're an org, not a com.
Thank you for listening.